World, what's up? What is our world? Hope you're having a fantastic start to the week. I had quite a nice weekend away. Went up to Durham for the first time and checked out the cathedral, which is absolutely stunning. If you're ever in that area, you have to check out this beautiful, beautiful cathedral. Then on the way back, I actually spent some time in Yorkshire. I can't believe that I've never been to Yorkshire before, only ever passed through it. Went to a lovely little town by the seaside called Seaham, where we walked along the cliff tops, which was beautiful, just as the sun was setting. What a lovely weekend it was. Now back in London and the weather is gorgeous, so I'm quite happy about that. Wasn't so happy about our performance at cricket yesterday. The Railway Tavern has got absolutely trounced and I was abysmal. But you have to take the rough with the smooth in life, and the sun is shining today, so one has to only think to the future. Now, before we get into a really, really nice interview with Niall McNamee, quick word from our sponsors, Endless Fugitive. They make really lovely casual wear, tops, hoodies, baseball caps, you name it. I wear their clothes all the time. They're comfortable and they look amazing. And if you use the promo code WORLDWHATSUP, you get a 10% discount. So why not take advantage of it? Okay, now, what's happening in the world this week? Tomorrow, Tuesday the 1st of June, is Say Something Nice Day. Now, I really like the sound of this. We're all far too keen to complain and or to criticise other people. We all do it way, way too much. Why not have a day where we just say something nice about somebody and try and go the whole day, yes, the whole day without saying anything negative? Or if you do say something negative, catch yourself, erase it and change it for something positive. I know it's really hard and I'm going to be giving it a go tomorrow. So let's all embrace that. Say Something Nice Day tomorrow. Thursday the 3rd is World Bicycle Day. Those of you who know me know I like to get out on the bike and do the canals and occasionally take on a hill. I can't think of any better exercise than getting out on the bike, especially on a beautiful day like this week. We're expecting some fantastic weather. So if you've got a bike, just take it for a little spin round the park. You see so much more when you're out on the bike. So why not give it a go? Friday the 4th of June is Hug Your Cat Day. And I know not everybody out there are cat people. I am a big cat person. We have 4 cats and it's Hug Your Cat Day. So I will be giving them all a very special big hug. I know some people are allergic to them, so that's understandable. But they bring me so much joy. They pretty much make me laugh every single day. They have such character and personality and they just don't take any nonsense. So, yeah, if you got a cat, give it a big hug on Friday. Also, the 4th is my big brother Jude's birthday, so happy birthday, bro. My guest today is Niall McNamee. He's an actor, musician and songwriter, born in Leicester, but very, very much a proud Irishman. I really enjoyed this chat with him. He's engaging, intelligent and very, very funny. He has starred in the movies The Party, Trouble, and alongside Jackie Chan in The Foreigner. As a musician, he already has a large following, even though he hasn't actually put anything out there yet. I really hope you enjoy this interview just as much as I did. World, what's up? What is up, world? Before we start, a quick mention to our sponsors, Endless Fugitive. You make quality designer clothes that make you feel good. So check out Endless Fugitive at endlessfugitive.co.uk. Right, today my guest is Niall McNamee. He's a singer, songwriter, and a really nice chap. I met him for the first time last week on the set of Love Without Walls, which he is one of the stars of. Welcome, Niall.
Thanks for having me, Andy. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, mate. I'm doing well. So, first of all, I understand you're named after a famous footballer. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm named after Niall Quinn, who played for Ireland and Arsenal and Man City. And I think when I was growing up, probably most famously for Sunderland. I think he scored against England the year before I was born. And I think then my dad went, right, it's definitely Niall. I do remember a conversation when I was younger, though, of me asking me mum and dad, oh, you know, why am I called Niall? And my dad went, you're named after Niall Quinn. And my mum went, I thought it was that poem that we read together. And my dad was going, oh, yeah, no, that too. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Niall of the Nine Hostages. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Do you know that poem?
No, I don't. But I know the goal. I got to meet him actually on a very on a big day for me when I was quite when I was just moved to London. I got my first agent and I bumped into him on the tube, and I just couldn't believe this day had happened. And it's not often you get to meet someone who's a hero and tell them you're named after them. And then I got the worst selfie in the world because, you know, he's so tall and I hadn't got the hang of it. So the angle was awful. He said, do you want me to take it again? And I said, no, I don't want to waste any more of your time, Niall. But good luck. Lovely man.
Because he's a really nice bloke. Because I remember years ago he used to drink in a club up in Muswell Hill called Manhattan Lights. And he was quite a regular in there. But yeah, those boys, they knew how to play hard and drink hard in those days, you know. It was a
different era. You couldn't get away with it now, I don't think. I think most footballers at any sort of professional level don't drink at all now, by all accounts, which makes any celebration party a bit mad. they're falling. I can only speak for my team, Leeds United, and say they're all skeletal. I'm sure they'll be on the floor after a sip of a Guinness. So, as far as I know, Niall Quinn, by the sounds of it, knew just how much to have and was great crack when he was playing. And, that's the era that I would have liked to play football in.
Yeah.
Do you know what? To be fair, when I was 18, 19, I don't know how I did it, but I used to be on nights out always before I'd be playing Sunday League, and I couldn't do that now. So as much as it shouldn't, it gives me a bit of extra respect for those players, because you're looking at them going, look at the pitches they're playing on. You know, they're stumbling like a drunk without a drink in them on those pitches, on those mud baths. So, what an era. What a great time.
Because I was likewise, we used to play Sunday League football in the mornings and we used to have a skinful and we'd be talking the big game the night before, score the hat trick tomorrow, and then we'd be struggling to run 10 yards.
Fag on the side of the pitch. It used to be a bit of an omen for me that if I threw up, I was going to score. And often that was what happened. I'd always throw up. That's a goal. McNamee's going to score one.
You got all the badness out of you.
Yeah.
So you're a proud Irishman. What's it mean to be an Irishman for you? You obviously, your dad is a proud Irishman because he named you after Big Niall.
Yeah. It's so strange, really. I mean, I've always been overly patriotic, I think. I went to secondary school in Leicester, or in Loughborough, I should say, and I was surrounded by a lot of different kind of groups of people from all over. It was a Catholic school, so it was basically Italians, Irish, Polish, and a mixture of loads of other things. And I was always the Irish kid at school. I didn't really stand a chance, really. My dad brainwashed me to support Ireland. My name is Niall McNamee. I just happened to love the Dubliners and Christy Moore and all that. So I think it was Peter O'Toole who said, and it's brilliant, if you get a chance, watch it on YouTube. But they asked him on an interview this, because obviously he was brought up in Leeds, I think. And they said, what does it mean to be Irish to you? And he takes a pause and goes, it's the center of my every moment and my total being. And I just thought, it's true. It's so funny. I know some people that aren't so patriotic wherever they're from. I know people who are brought up in England and have Irish parents and aren't fussed. Maybe it's a football thing, but for me, it's always been, as Peter O'Toole says, the centre of my every moment and my total being.
You do a very good Peter O'Toole, I've got to say.
Thank you. Yes, well, speaking of drinking.
There's a man you want to have a drink with, eh?
Every single young Irish actor I know looked at Peter O'Toole and Richard Harris interviews and go, that's what London's like. Yeah. I want to go. And and you realize those days are over, man. You can't be doing that stuff. They won't let you do anything. But some of those stories, the romance, there's a mystic nature to Irishness and art that I love a lot. And I think as I've got older, I've certainly an insult to anyone who's English, but the older I get, the more I realize just how different we are as people. Not really different in loads of ways. In some ways, we're very similar. We're neighbors after all. But generally speaking, you know, there's just something about hanging out with someone from Ireland and the references and the total gap, you know, the different reference points and pop culture and just stuff like that totally separates you. And I guess I know a few Irish people that sort of say that they find that as they get older, that there's such a difference, and the difference in what carries respect in terms of art and what carries value, you know. You see that in music and the live music scene, certainly in Belfast and Dublin. I love that, you know. That being said, I love being the Irish man in England. So whether I'd ever move back, I don't know.
I know what you say. There is definitely a difference of energy and vibe in a lot of attitudes towards theater and acting and indeed music. Because I spent quite a lot in Ireland, because my missus is actually an Irish girl, a Kilkenny girl.
Is she now? I didn't know that. She's Kilkenny.
Yes, she's a Kilkenny girl. I know what you say. There's definitely a different energy and a different way of thinking for Irish people and English people.
I don't know if this sounds like something I for some reason shouldn't say, really, but I do really believe this, especially in London. I've definitely, and I know a lot of Irish people have said it, and vice versa. I feel there is a very similar attitude with Irish people and Caribbean people. Mm-hmm. I've found that. There's so many Londoners who are Caribbean with an Irish last name, and you know, we all mix together. But there is a very similar. Maybe it's just the fact that we're all in London together, and you know, there's that immigration story at a similar time. But I don't know. I guess we understand each other a little bit. I've always found that.
There's always been that sort of bond, because like we both came here on the bottom runs, like trying to make a way. There's that old adage that you see on all the places, no dogs, no Irish, no blacks. You know, dogs got top billing, you know. So there is that sort of thing, you know, like, because my mum, she was like a cleaner. She worked for British Rail for years and some of her best mates on there were like Irish ladies that they just worked together. And because there seemed to be like some sort of common bond, and they got on really well. And I think she always loved their sense of humour, because Irish have a very unique and very dry sense of humour, which I got to say I like as well a lot.
Yeah. I don't want to bring it too dark, but something that I found in the last few years with the way the world's going, and it's quite an upsetting thing, is that very thing, as you said, that brings us together, I think, has been used almost as an excuse recently by a lot of Irish Americans, especially in the, you know, the Republican side of recent years, and that kind of thing of, well, you know, how can we be racist? My great grandfather was on the same boat, or what? Do you know what I mean? And it's not the same. And it can't be used as an excuse, but you know, I think people do jump to that sometimes, and other wrong people do. It's an interesting one.
I do find it interesting how people can do something and not see it from other people's points of view. Because I remember a few years ago when a lot of the Polish people were coming over to England, and a lot went to Ireland as well.
Oh, God.
And I remember being in and around Kilkenny, and I had people going, God, they're coming over here, taking our jobs. How can Irish people ever say that about anyone?
It's unbelievable. A culture that's totally built on immigration or emigrating. And, it's baffling.
It really surprised me.
Yeah. My girlfriend, Imelda, she wrote a poem shortly after the George Floyd shooting last year. And she's a brilliant poet. And it's called You Don't Get to Be Racist and Irish. And some people have took that as you can't be racist and Irish, like, as in, like, even if you tried, you wouldn't be able to, like, you just wouldn't manage it. But what she means is that you don't get to be. If you're proud of Irish history, if you're proud of where you've come from and you understand what being Irish is and what it has been, then you can't be. But there has been a rise in it. I think I've been very sad in recent years to, I guess I kind of maybe naively at a younger age thought that we didn't have that problem in Ireland, and we do. And in some ways it's worse because we're newer to having people coming to live in our country. And that's very sad, but I hope that will change, but it's definitely on the rise there. And I know Imelda has received awful messages for that, being called a traitor and all sorts.
I'd love to have a read of that if she wouldn't mind.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I'll send it over. But I said at the end of it, when after everything, and whilst I wouldn't want her to go through any more of that and get any abuse for that, it was very useful in its own way because it did shine a light on that, a light that I hadn't seen. You know, there's no escaping from, like, you know, you look at yobs and football fans who go abroad, and we all know that every club has their certain ones. Like, England, you know, has a slightly right-wing generalization, I think, about other countries. I think England's, you know, there's a lot of tolerant people in England. But I think even for the sake, like, I thought Irish people wouldn't be racist because normally we do the opposite.
I think you've got to get racist people everywhere. You're always going to get a faction of it. I mean, I was just thinking, just the other day I went to the football with the kids. And I'm a West Ham fan. I have been for like 46 years. I love West Ham. And they've always had a reputation of being pretty racist. I haven't encountered it too much. But one thing that did upset me the other day when the guys took the knee, and literally it was the only and first and last game of the season, there was a little section that started booing. And I got to say, I mean, it did upset me for about the first 10, 15 minutes of the game. Then I got a hold of myself and said, it's just a small faction. There was like 10,000 people. It could only be maybe 10 or 20. But, you know, it does hurt you for a while, and then you just realise it's always going to be that element, isn't there?
Yeah, I did. You know what? It's funny you said that, because I haven't actually. I remember before the Leeds game praying that we wouldn't be one of those teams, and ultimately every team's going to be one of those teams in some fractions, as you said. But I'm glad they're still doing it, because I remember when they started doing it during lockdown, and I didn't know if they were going to do it for that long, or how, you never know how long these things are going to last. And some teams officially stopped doing it. I think Derby stopped doing it or something like that. I don't know why. They would always link it with a different movement or something like that was the same, but not. But I remember thinking it's so important that we do this for as long as possible, but certainly until the fans are in the ground, because there is going to be uproar. And sadly, you learn a lot about your friends, and not any like really close friends of mine, but a bit like when you see someone you've known for a while litter for the first time, and it totally changes the way that you see them. I have had mates that sort of go, even just going, oh, well, you know, keep politics out of football, and oh, well, it's all this nonsense. And I'm going, wow, I really don't see how you don't value that as a moment. And you know, you've seen it in the NFL and basketball in the US for years. And I guess I kind of, again, naively thought that maybe if that was in football, then we'd get away with it, no bother. But there's something going on. I hope a few people's minds have been changed. I hope people have been educated a little bit, at least.
So, there's our little...
Anyway.
let's talk about you. So, I'd say being a musician and an actor for a while. Mm. So, how come it's taken so long for you to release your music and to get it out there to the world?
Well, I came to London when I was 18, and I wanted to do both. In my head, I came there, and if someone had asked me on the first day, what are you in London for? I would have said, I'm a singer-songwriter, and I'm an actor, and I want to do both, and I want them to help each other. And I think that's a really good idea, and I couldn't pick between the two. Acting's a bit more linear, I think, in the journey of it. You know, you generally speaking, first steps drama school. This is like like what people would, if you had to write a normal list of it. Drama school. And then you do your shows at the end of drama school, and then you get an agent, and then your agent puts you up for a job, and then you get the job or you don't, and if you get it, you get paid, and then you might get another one, and that's it. Music is like all over the place. There's no rule or rhyme or reason. There is a little bit of having to know someone who can record something and might be able to do it for free, or you need to get it. My plan always was, right, I'll get work as an actor and my first big paycheck, or like I'll get a TV series or something. I know it sounds cynical, but I'd be like, if I get loads of followers or something, or something, or I get popular in some way, then I've got the perfect amount of to make my own studio and do all that. And that was me kind of plan. And when I wasn't acting, I'd be, you know, I still do, or I was before lockdown, playing all the pubs, Irish pubs in London, you know. Sorry, my thing's cut out. Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Friday, you know, whenever. And there was part of me, I think, when I was young, that I kind of thought that's what you did. You went and played in pubs and then you hope for the best. And probably now I realise that that's a decent way to earn money outside of, you know, outside of acting jobs, if it's a bit quiet. It's certainly better than the building site, which I was doing before, and it was killing me and it wasn't paying very well. So I sort of just found my feet, and then I got to a point where I was kind of like, I mean, I'm not going to say that I'm getting old, because I'm 27, but it's like, I'm a lot older than I was when I was 22, you know. Those are big years. And I just thought, I am not doing this right now. And I wasn't doing it last year, and I wasn't recording the year before. So when am I going to do it? And I guess I just found a way. It was just my aim that year. So I just concentrated on it and realized that I had to do it, because I'm thinking about it all the time. I've been writing songs and doing gigs of my own, building up a fan base. Do you know what? I used to be quite embarrassed. I'd go and play my own gigs, and we'd sell it out, and it would be like a ticketed thing, not just in Irish pubs, but like in venues. And someone would hear the songs and they'd be like, oh, where can we hear you? Like, I love your stuff, or I like your stuff. Is there anywhere? And I go, nowhere. And they'd be like, kind of like, why have you not? That makes no sense. Like, even the smallest musicians who are just starting out have something.
They're getting their stuff straight on Spotify and everything.
Yeah, totally. I didn't really know how to do that. But also, I was kind of, the songs were fully formed in my head, and I didn't really want to put out anything that was less than that. And I certainly didn't want to, it sounds weird, but I didn't want to just like put it out to no one either. I wanted to build a following. And the first time where I felt good about the way I'd done it was the night my manager signed me, because I knew he was in the audience and I really wanted him to sign me. And it suddenly hit me that he was coming to a gig that was sold out, and there was the Dublin Castle in Camden. It's great.
Love that. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind
great
of,
nights
it,
in there.
Yeah. It felt like, I remember, I didn't have to pick that place, but I remember sort of on a romantic sense, and I often go with my romantic head on things. I think it's why I became a brickie, or rather worked on the building site and got a van, because I thought that'll be a good romantic story when it all fucking works out. It wasn't. But I remember spotting him, watching it, and thinking, he's here at the Dublin Castle, it's sold out, and enough people thought they could get tickets late and didn't, so there's a queue out the door. And all these people are singing my songs word for word, and they can't hear it anywhere unless they're at the gig. And it was then I thought, I'm showing this manager here that I've done a lot of work here without anything. And it was a selling point for him, because he was like, well, all you need to do is release them. You've got your audience ready. This is strange. So part of me sometimes thinks maybe I should have done it earlier, or I wish I had and stuff. But then, you know, it's yourself, important. often think these things come when they come. I remember Ricky Gervais saying that, because I think he won an award for The Office when he was 40. I think that was when he was. He'd done all sorts, and everything was going brilliant, and he became a millionaire overnight or whatever. And he turned to his long-term partner and said, why didn't I do this before? And she went, because you couldn't. All those experiences came together at that point, and that's when it is. And I remember thinking, yeah, that old Irish phrase, what's meant for you won't pass you by. You
know? Absolutely. And be honest with you, at 27, you're doing all right. Mind you saying that, Amy Winehouse and was it Coke come in and Jimi Hendrix, they all were dead. At least you made it to 27. When's your birthday?
4th of January.
You still got a while to go.
I know. Do you know, I really do think that I'm happy to be 27. I know that It's like anything. As soon as I turn 28, I'll be like 27, so young. It's as simple as that. But I realized that I would be in the middle of my football career if I was a footballer. And like, if I was decent, then a club might sign me, but they'd be like, well, how many years has he got left? He's got injuries. So when you're such a football fan, you're seeing like, the Leeds goalkeeper's 19. If a goalkeeper from my club is 19 years old, then that's going to make 27 feel a bit older than it is, you know.
You said like you love both acting and your music. So is there any preference there, or are they both exactly the same?
I like them both for different reasons. I do think my mother is always right on things, you know, which is very... Yeah. I mean, I don't always realize or agree until a few years later. So if she said something that I disagree with now, I'd be like, oh my God, my mum's finally got something wrong. And then always about 4 years later, I'm like, she was right. My mum always said, well, she said to me when I was going to drama school in England, in London, sorry. She said, I think you're a great actor and I'm really proud of you that you want to do this and stuff. But she went, I think you're a singer-songwriter. I think that's what you are. I think you're a singer. And I do think that's probably the thing that comes most naturally to me. That being said, I've not had a shot at acting in the way that I am doing now with Love Without Walls, where I'm like the lead in it and I've been trusted, and the director Jane, who you know is just wonderful. Like, I've not had that experience yet. So I perhaps look back now and think maybe there's been a few more confidence knocks over the last few years than I thought. And right now I feel really good. But that being said, do you know the way I think probably music, I'm probably better at music. And the reason I say that is because if someone said, someone gave me a monologue to learn or told me to write something to perform and said, right, go out there and in the audience will be Al Pacino and, you know, Robert De Niro and, not just a cast of gangster movies, but you know, like the greats, Meryl Streep, whatever, then I would be insanely nervous and worried. But if someone said to me, right, there's your guitar, go out and play one of your songs, Billy Joel, Elton John, Sinatra, there in the audience, I'd be thinking, I can't wait to show them what I've got.
See, that is so interesting. I'm so, because I'm listening to an audiobook at the moment called Everything is Figure Outable. And there's so many things that you've been saying there. It just so remind me about the not getting it out there. But once you start is getting out there, things start to happen. And I've been like that a lot myself. And so I've like had ideas, like I've written scripts and I've done nothing with them. But as soon as you pick something up and you start doing something with it, it does build momentum, you know, and it gets it out there. So, and I'm a massive believer in your instincts, and I think if your instincts are telling you that's what you are, that's what you are. You know, it's as simple as that. Your instincts are telling you, you know what, that's the way it's going to go. And we live in a world where you can do both. As you say, you're in Love Without Walls, so, and I think that's going to be a great opportunity. That's what I'm going to say. So what's it like working? I've worked with Jane, but only in little small snippets. What's it like working with her day to day?
Fantastic. I mean, it's very focused. I mean, it's hard to explain, really. It's like, it doesn't feel like working necessarily. There's no stress. It kind of just, I mean, it's obviously different for everyone, but for whatever reason, I think we must just have the same tastes. And I totally and truly trust Jane. And I think that's because of Jane, but it's also because I'm a bit, I've grown up a bit, you know. I think before I wouldn't say I'm a control freak, but, you know, I definitely have ideas and sometimes I'd be like pushing them. But now if I try something out, which Jane is happy for me to try little things or whatever, and she goes, no, then I immediately just go, well, then she's right. And it's easy then. So I think that's brilliant. I really do feel trusted. And it's wonderful. It's been great working with Jane. I mean, and Shana and Karen, they're a great team. I do think I work really well with women. My agent, my acting agents are all women, and you know, I don't know why. I think I react well to having a boss who's a woman. because I don't know, I trust their instincts. It's, yeah.
Well, with Jen, you know, she has excellent instincts. And even though I was only there for a day, I always think that the energy of any place comes from the top. And mm-hmm. the vibe on that set was just so nice. Everybody was just chilled, worked well together. When there's work to be done, everyone gets on and does it. But it was just, I've been in sets, I'm sure you have, where when the person at the top isn't right and has got some angst, that angst goes right across the board and it's a horrible environment. And I don't think you'd get that with Jane. I can't think of anybody who's ever said it was hard work working with Jane. She's
no, she's proper. She cares about people and she cares about the project. I can't see her being a director that, because you often come across directors who don't want to be on a job. I mean, I know this is Jane's project, but it is funny sometimes you meet a director and you go, I don't even know how this has come about because I can tell you don't want to do this. Yeah, she just has a lot of time for people and really amazing. I can't say I have loads of similar experiences, like directly similar experiences to compare it to. I've done plenty of plays and I've done short films and had brilliant directors in both. Yeah, I don't know if it feels like I met Jane at the right time for me anyway, you know, because I feel good in myself and, yeah, again, she trusts me, you know.
So, yeah, tell us, how did you get involved in the project in the first place?
Well, see, this is it. Like you know how I was saying before, I love the romantic story of how something came about. Well, it's like she knew that because I was doing a gig in that little gap during lockdown last year in the summer, probably August, I think. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was in that little gap of time where we could go to the pub and it was table service. And I had this gig and just in the corner of a pub. And because it had been so long, like normally I wouldn't invite my friends to me playing for 200 quid on a night, you know, like in front, just as the entertainment in the corner. But it had been so long, I told a few people. And it ended up being this huge night where like 60, 70 people turned up just to this little tiny pub called Feely's in Clapham, which quite frankly, I love it. It looks like it would be perfect for a film set, something really like London gangster about it, like old fashioned, proper. You don't see pubs like that anymore, do you know? Not a franchise, not a menu in sight, just a pub.
I feel sometimes I feel really sad I still haven't got my place. I'd love to get you down there doing a gig because we used to do live music. We used to have a blues jam on every Thursday night. And
class.
And where is that? We're in Cratch End. And, and we used to have, bands coming over from Chicago. We used to have we had every type of music. And I'm like, I got a soft spot for Irish folk music. I mean, that's another thing Irish and black people have in common. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. Like when I was a kid, if the telly broke down, we were listening to Jim Reeves. And that was, for me, it was absolute torture. They couldn't fix that telly quick enough. But and I was talking to a couple of black friends, and it was the same in their houses as well.
Yeah.
Country and Western was really, really popular, you know. So
I didn't know that, actually. I didn't know that was popular.
It was hugely popular. Like, my mum was a mad fan of Jim Reeves, and all of her friends were as well. And a few other country and Western singers, Roy Orbison and all those guys, they were like, it was very, very popular.
I did not know that was popular. I mean, obviously it's in Ireland. Country scene.
It would have been great to have you down there. But I love Irish music because like most of my friends around here when we were growing up, they were like of Irish descent. And there were two brothers, John and Peter, and their sisters sang in an Irish band. And they dragged us there when we were 17 one night. But it was just so beautiful because there's some of those songs, some of the ballads, and they both had amazing voices. Geraldine and Patricia, big shout out to them. But so whenever they played, we'd go and watch them. And so you got to learn some of the old big Irish anthems, and I love that vibe.
Well, that's it. I couldn't believe when I got to London just how many like people who weren't Irish knew some big Irish songs. Like, I mean, I suppose the Pogues helped with that. The Pogues kind of, you know, gave it, they're all second generation and that gave a massive boost to Irish music. And whilst there was plenty of other musicians around doing similar work, I think the way the Pogues moved it into punk and stuff around the time was just, you know, unbelievable. And it makes so much sense now And it's something I try and do a little bit, but, you know, I suppose back then it would have just been unthought of, so, or unheard of, I should say. So, yeah, yeah. I've always loved Irish music. The lyrics and the melodies, you know, there's, I always think it doesn't matter what if you slow down most Irish songs, even like the fast ones, even they and just sing the tune, really they could all be lullabies. And I mean that like in the harshest of songs. Most Pogue songs, if you slow them down, could be lullabies with the melody. And I think that resonates. We're kind of at a time now in music where I don't understand a load of pop music myself. I'm not knocking it, it's just not my thing. But, you know, if something's a good tune, like a nice melody is ultimately what music is. And then you've got obviously rhythm, and that's a big part of it on its own. But for me, a melody is what breaks or makes a song, you know, not the production, not what you add into it. It's about a nice hook and a melody. I don't like using the word hook because it sounds quite manufactured or like you're trying to hook people in, but it is that sort of, whether it sticks in your head or not is the be all and end all of it, really, I think.
Oh, we got sidetracked there. Come on. You were telling the story. So,
oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah. So I was playing in this pub and it was getting a bit busy for COVID. And I was a bit worried, but I was playing away and having a great time. And I wasn't driving, so I had a few drinks and all my pals were there. And then this woman came up to me and I thought she was the old Bill. Because I thought that, like, it was too busy or something like that. And it was Jane. And she caught me on my break and sort of said, look, I've got this script. It's about this singer-songwriter trying to make it in London. And he's married. And it's not about the singer-songwriter. It's about a couple. And one of them is a singer-songwriter. And she said, you know, would you be interested in giving it a read? And I kind of thought, I think she thought that I'd be a bit more coy about it. But to me, I just heard it and went, that sounds like an incredible opportunity. Now, I didn't know Jane, and it was a short conversation. She was very nice, but quiet, a lot shyer than I would think of her now, really. And I remember thinking, well, that might or might not be a thing. It was the kind of thing the next morning going, did that happen last night? Or is that something that, you know? And she sent me the script and I read it and I was blown away. And then she invited me to meet Shana to have a read through. And then I remember finishing the audition and thinking, well, if I don't get that, I'm going to be quite upset and kind of not know what to do next, because it's about a singer-songwriter who's failing in London. And that's me.
If you don't get that, then what are you going to get?
Exactly. So I was delighted to get the call.
So what was Jane doing this? You just happened to be in the pub that night.
So as far as I know, Jane was looking everywhere for whoever was going to play this part of Paul, which I'm playing. And I think she was like literally looking on Instagram, putting in singer-songwriters, London, all this sort of stuff. And she found me and I think she started following me. And she was going to get in touch with my agent and send over the script and see if I fancied doing a self-tape or something. But then so I had this gig and thought, well, I'll go down and spy on him because I'm going to get to see him essentially doing one of the scenes that we're in the movie of, which is playing in the corner of a pub with a load of drunkards around and all that. And apparently her and her husband, Lewis, were sat at the back, sort of whispering to each other, going, what do you reckon? Is that him? Is that him? Or whatever. And they must have liked what they saw. But it's one of those things. I'm glad I didn't know they were there. I would have probably messed it up or something. I was hammered. So hammered, I remember it. Oh God!
Is that why you're thinking? Did I dream that when you wake up the next day?
Yeah, totally. I was like, oh, and I couldn't remember the conversation well enough. I was thinking maybe she was just some woman who like was just a local who was like going, I've got this script in my head and you should play it. Oh yeah, have you? Like, you know what I mean? It was so. I love that. I love that. That's the way it happened. It suits me. And as I said, instincts and some things won't pass you by or whatever. And that narrative makes total sense in my life story so far and in what I want my life to be. That's how I want things to come about. In a world that's so manufactured and everything's online and people discover music on Spotify and, you know, I'm trying to promote stuff at the moment and it's a minefield of algorithms, rhythms and stuff. I love the fact that she came to watch me in a gig and came and talked to me outside in the smoking area. Yeah.
So yeah. Tell us a little bit about the film. What's it about?
So yeah, Love What I Was is about a young married couple who kind of fall in hard times. Sophie and Paul are the names of the characters. And Sophie's a photographer studying. Paul is a singer-songwriter who's trying to sort of write music and get it out there and gig around London, but at the same time is learning the knowledge to be a cab driver as a sort of backup. And as many people will have felt during lockdown, I'm sure, it kind of shows you just how hand-to-mouth people are. They're not wealthy, but they're not poor. They're kind of, I see it as they're where they should be for their age, and they're making things work and trying to make their dreams come true, as it were. And a list of things just go wrong, you know, an unpaid this or, something breaks and they can't afford to fix it. And then suddenly they're out on their arse, and it really tackles homelessness and that kind of how difficult it is to put the system to help you when you essentially fall out of it in a couple of days. And it doesn't take long. You know, I was reading the script and looking at it going, I'm really trying to find, the cynical part of your brain is looking for where could they have done better here. And often the case with homeless people is that it was unlucky, you know. I really do believe that.
I think so too. I think sometimes people are very keen to judge, but it's surprisingly how easy it is to fall. If you lose your home, you can't get a job. If you lose your job, you can't get your home. So it's a vicious circle, and it's easily said. Done. I remember I had to write a scene for a monologue for a play I was taking up to Edinburgh a few years ago. So I was just talking to homeless people and watching loads of videos, and so often than not they go, one minute they're just in a, you know, they're working, and it could be maybe a trauma in their life, like they lose their partner or their partner leaves or something, they lose their home, and then they lose their job, and then before you know it they're sleeping on the street. So it can happen very easily, and we should never be judging people who it's happened to.
No, and circumstances out of your control. I mean, like, my mum and dad aren't millionaires, but like they've definitely been able to, you know, at a stretch help me in moments that I've struggled, and if they weren't there, then I don't know what I would have done, you know. Just like, I mean, God, I remember I managed to get it sorted, but the most stressful moment of my life was the year after I got my biggest acting role in something, because I got the big paycheck and it was the first year I was paying tax, and I just totally underestimated how much tax people pay. Like, I saved, in my head, I'd saved so much money. I've been so clever, and it was nowhere near the amount I needed. And I was like, I have gone from being the most wealthy I have ever even thought I'd be to in debt. And, you know, there's something very comforting about having nothing compared to debt. And you know, the help and hard work and right nailing down. But I mean, really, without a few friends and whatever, I would have been out on my arse, and I was lucky there that I had support around me, and I never want to be in that position again. What was the
project?
The movie was The Foreigner. It's on Netflix at the moment, actually. But it was done a good few years ago, and I was working on a building site, so I didn't have any money, but I was grand. And then suddenly I did this audition and got this part that I didn't expect, and found out that I was going to get collected in the morning. I need to be off the building site for a couple of months because I'm going to the gym tomorrow to start choreographing a fight with Jackie Chan. And you're going to be, you know, in this movie, you kill his daughter and he comes after you. And like, it was kind of like, but why, how? No. Cause this is the bit where I auditioned for it and I did really well, but no, there's like a famous person who does this bit. And they were like, no. So they gave me it, and the, you know, our typical agents were like, oh, it's not really enough. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Well, really, by today's standards, you should be. I'm like, just say yes. Just say yes. They know I'm going to do this. I will pay them. But, you know, and actually, like, it wasn't a life-changing amount of money. It was a normal salary, but or a normal day wage on a movie like that. I'd just never done it before. So it was more money than I'd ever had. One day amount was more than I'd had in my account at one time. And I thought I was being really sensible with it. And then and it just, I don't know. I didn't go on holiday, so I don't know what's
probably plenty of Guinness was drunk ideas.
Yeah, so. I think that was, I genuinely, that was, I remember I'd moved in with me mates at the time, and we just all moved in London. It was our first gaff, and all of us had just got a really good part in something. So we were all a bit flush, and like, I don't remember it. So that tells you.
That's how you know it was a good time. You were living up to the O'Toole way.
Well, there's a house full of actors who all idolized the man. So, you know, I think we're all walking around in our long coats and boots. And, it was great.
Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying. There's a big difference between having no money and then having debt. Because the debt, it's in your head all the time. And that's something that actors have to deal with a lot, you know.
Well, what's weird as well is that I'm saying that, like, having nothing is better than debt. But it changes, doesn't it, depending on what wealth you're working with? Because football clubs are like small nations at the moment. But then you find out they're billions in debt or whatever. And you go, how does that work, though? Because you're still working. How can you be in debt? I don't understand it. Or like millionaires or people would be in debt like 60 grand. And you go, but doesn't that mean that you're done? And somehow doesn't always. But for some people, it does. I don't know about the world yet. I'll work it out soon. You know? Hopefully, I'll never have anywhere near enough money to worry about it. You know,
I got to say, I've been... since I knew I was going to do this interview, I've been listening to your music, and it is so nice. It's just like you got a lovely voice. You know, I've just been reading and just relaxing, listening to it for like the last couple of days. It's fantastic. That's what I was going to say. Would it be cool to stick a song on at the end of this?
Yeah, totally. I'd
love to do that. I've done it once before. I think it's just a nice, fitting way to like end. So if you send me that, I'll stick that on the end. I'll let you.
Fabulous. Yeah. For sure, I will.
So, who would you say has been the biggest influence on you as an actor and as a musician?
Who's been the biggest influence? Well, it's changed over the years, but biggest influence. I'd say, as an actor, that changes, of course. I wouldn't say I've had an influence, or I can't think of anyone that I'm like trying to replicate. I do love actors who are quite, you know, it changes, I suppose. But one actor that I've always wanted to replicate, or rather, I look at his career and I think that's what I want, is Michael Sheen. Because I've always loved biopics. I've always loved those movies. I've always loved it on stage. And I've always had a knack for accents and impressions to a certain extent.
I was going to say, because your O'Toole was pretty good. So who else do you do?
So sometimes you just go to mimic someone, and it's either like, oh, I need to work on that, or, oh my God, by accident, I'm going to jinx it now. But I accidentally did a bang on Farage yesterday when I was talking to someone. The thing is, I lost it in the end there. It's nonsense. That's going to sound terrible. But, I do a few. I could always randomly do some easy. Like, do you watch Family Guy?
I do, yeah.
So I can do a oh hello Quagmire. That was the Cleveland. But I always loved Michael Sheen because he played Brian Clough and he played Tony Blair a couple of times, and he played Frost and he played Kenneth Williams. And I just
I haven't seen that Kenneth. In all the others,
yeah,
Kenneth Williams.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, The Damned United, I think, maybe because it was about Leeds, I think that was the first time I knew who Michael Sheen was. It was when I was at school. Now, young man, as far as I'm concerned, the vision you do for me is through all your pots. I just thought, that's so cool. I was driving my parents mad walking around doing Brian Clough speeches for about 4 months. But I always loved that. And actually, my first acting job was playing Edward Heath, the Prime Minister before Thatcher, on the West End. And I loved it. It was like a dream come true. It was the part I was after. And then I've played a few real people. Fran O'Toole from the Miami Show Band, which is an Irish band. A brilliant Netflix series you should watch, by the way, is the Miami Show Band Massacre. It's an incredible story about a big band in Ireland in the 70s who were murdered. And I played the lead singer in that.
You're freaking me out now. That is because I literally literally, not this Sunday, the Sunday before, I was talking to a mate. I've known him for 30 odd years, and we were talking, and he told me the story of the Miami Show Band, and I said, yeah. "What?" I said, "How do people not know about this? How do people?" Know? He goes, "There's a film." He goes, "You got to watch it, and you're in it."
Yeah. Oh no. So no, I'm not in the film. So the amazing piece of work that you need to see is a documentary on Netflix. And it's fantastic. So there was a stage play / musical of that that did the Gaiety, and it did the Opera House in Belfast, and it did a tour of Ireland, and I did that, and I just getting to see his mannerisms and stuff, and played Neil McCormick and Chasing Bono. I'd love a career of doing biopics, of getting to research someone and get their likeness. That's what I'd really love to do. I had an audition to get a self-tape done, because I'm desperate to play Paul McCartney. I've always wanted to play him. Might be a bit old for the movie in question, but
you could carry that off. You could definitely carry off looks wise.
I'll send you my tape after this. Yeah, and see what you think. So yeah, that's kind of it. But in terms of music, Christy Moore, The Pogues, the storytelling of Christy Moore has in his songs, I've just always loved. They've always stuck with me. I don't really like the phrase storytelling. It's been nicked by wankers in rehearsal rooms. but there is something to be said for just being able to really picture what's going on in a song. And I've always loved that. And I suppose I could say Christy Moore about that. And I could say Shane McGowan. But ultimately, that's Irish music, isn't it? That's just what it is. And, you know, in terms of songwriting, I mean, Billy Joel, God, Frank Sinatra as a vocalist. And again, that beautiful kind of lullaby-like melody is something that I chase always, and as a test. So no one on their own, but certainly a mix of a few.
So all these influences come in when you sit down and you start writing. You think it's got to be about the melody.
Yeah, I think so. I've had to do this in lockdown, but I very rarely will sit down at a piano or sit down with a guitar and go, right, I'm going to sit here for an hour and it's time to write a song. Normally I'll be tinkering away and then, oh, that sounds nice. And then words start coming in. And then eventually when I think I've written the full thing, and I'll be like singing gibberish, making up words, making up rhymes, and some of it won't make sense. And just slowly, when I come back round to the next bit, there'll be a word that's stuck or a phrase that's stuck. And I go, that's nice. What does that mean? And then I write it out. And then I think to myself, God, I would hate to stand on stage and read poetry. But if I had to, as a poem, would I be pleased with that? And if I'm not, then I have to change it. And that's kind of my rule. And the melody's a bit more mythical than that. I don't really know where that comes from. Yeah, I can't read or write music, so I it's kind of all by ear, and I taught myself. So
some of the greatest musicians did that, you know.
Yeah, I think that technical aspect would maybe, I can only speak for myself, would maybe hold me back, because it does feel like my fingers are finding where to go on the keys. I don't like sounding arty about it at all. I don't know why, but you know, I don't want to sound too ethereal or anything. It just kind of, you know, I do find the way people say a song fell into me lap, it's kind of true. I just fucking hate saying it. So sorry, I should have asked if I'm allowed to swear.
Well, it's a bit late now. But I can say, gig-wise, have you got anything lined up?
Yes.
I'd love to come and see you in action.
Mate, get down. You've got a ticket on the door, man. Yeah, unbelievably, from where we are now, because everyone's still wearing masks and you know, it's still quite tight on things. Next month, the 25th of June, I'm going to be playing in Nels in Hammersmith. It's 400-seater, and it's going to be full capacity, no social distancing, which just is terrifying. But more than anything, just I can't believe that's happening next month. Excited.
I can't wait to see it.
Awesome, yeah.
Can I bring the missus?
Absolutely. You've got to get a Kilkenny woman there. She'll be right at home.
She'll love it. She'll absolutely love it. Okay, final question. Now, if you were to bump into the young you when you was, you know, 13, 14, what would you say to yourself?
I would say, I know there's lots of people telling you this at the moment, but seriously, be yourself. Because I just used to go, oh, as if, no way. You know that famous scene in most rom-coms where someone comes back from a bad date and he goes, oh, it went terribly. Well, I did everything you said. I was myself. He goes, I didn't mean it. I always kind of thought that. But the other thing I'd say is just cut yourself some slack. I've spent a lot of years, and I think a lot of people do when they're, especially first moving to London, being hard on themselves, you know. I enjoyed myself in London when I first moved here, but it's stressed. I'd be stressing about not working and stressing about, like, things weren't going my way. I felt like I wasn't on the right. Right now, I don't look back at those gaps and think, what a waste it had there. So I think just to enjoy myself and to be myself, you know. I know it sounds a bit boring, but that really is one for me, I think.
See, I ask this question a lot, and it's amazing how often that is the answer, because we try so hard to be what we think other people want us to be, especially when we're younger. But as you get older, you think, I'm perfectly good as I am, you know. So
yeah, but you understand why. It's not cool. You can't be yourself when you're a teenager. That's insane. I get it. Now, my younger self isn't a teenager. If I went back to my younger self who was a teenager at school, I'd say, not right now, but soon, be yourself. But for now, just stay, just keep your head down, just move on. Don't talk to him. No, don't swallow it. Don't swallow it.
Brilliant.
That was drugs, by the way, not anything else.
No, what a lovely conversation. Thanks for that. I really appreciate you coming on. I know you've had a long day. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, mate.
I really hope you enjoyed that interview with Niall. I really, really found it fun, and he's such a lovely guy. I'm looking forward to seeing him gigging soon and seeing him in Jane Gull's feature, Love Without Walls, which I'm sure will be amazing. And I leave you now with Step by Step, Niall's new song, which I think is lovely. Enjoy. And see you next week, when my guest will be Anthony W. Johnson, choreographer, writer, actor, and now producing his first feature film. Bye-bye.
Standing on the brink, and I'm not tired. I've seen the place where you're inspired. And how do we get out of there so well? I'm in a tiny little spell. Wired. 'Cause days turn to weeks, and in months we reached our peaks. I thought we're done, and I won't know from now on if we're here or if we're gone. Drank too much. Those eyes begin to shine. They said we'll be just fine, and I don't mind where you go. I just want to follow. My front door, the keys won't work. I've drank too much. Those eyes begin to shine. They said we'll be just fine, and I don't mind where you go. I just want to follow.